There are many legendary figures associated with the opening of the American West. From Kit Carson to Chief Sitting Bull, Jed Smith to Johann Sutter. But one of the most enduring legendary figures doesn't, in general, have a name or a face. In a West we imagine filled with dangers around every turn, he is the collaboration of hundreds of brave, daring young men of small stature and stout hearts. He burned brightly for a mere 18 months, but in that time he literally created a myth and opened the West to the rest of the world. He was the Pony Express rider, relaying the mail across vast open spaces like a ghost messenger, tying together a country that was on the verge of coming apart at the seams. Unlike other legends, the Pony Express rider did not have to wait the test of time and historical revision to become famous. Although each rider in that 1860-61 period was anonymous and interchangeable, there was legend to be had from the time the first rider left St. Joe, Missouri for Sacramento. Presently the driver exclaims, "Here he comes!" Every neck is stretched further and every eye strained wider, away across the endless dead level of the prairie. A black speck appears against the sky, and it is plain that it moves. Well, I should think so. In a second or two, it becomes a horse and rider, rising and falling, sweeping toward us nearer and nearer, growing more and more distinct, more and more sharply defined, nearer and still nearer, and the flutter of the hoofs comes faintly to the ear. Another instant, and a whoop and a hurrah from our upper deck, a wave of the rider's hand, but no reply, and man and horse burst past our excited faces and go winging away like a belated fragment of a storm. So Mark Twain, in Roughing It, described the transit of a Pony Express rider overtaking the stage on which he and his brother Orion were riding on their 24-day journey from St. Joe to Carson City in July of 1861. The Pony Express riders, changing horses every 10 miles and riding 50 miles at a shift, makes the trip from St. Joe to Sacramento in 8 or 10 days. The importance of the Pony Rider to that brief moment in time cannot be overstressed. What was to become the United States was growing, not from east to west, but from both coasts toward the middle. And the middle was vast, desolate, and dangerous. Yet only a few years later, it would be crossed by a massive railroad project, its communications carried not in the boxes strapped to the back of a heaving Mustang, but through telegraph wires that nearly paralleled the Pony Express route. The letters that the Pony Express carried kept Western financial markets in San Francisco in touch with their counterparts in the East. The secret messages relayed between Washington, D.C. and San Francisco attempted to keep California in the Union as the nation headed toward fracture. The dispatches kept Western newspapers abreast of important happenings in the East. The idea of improving communication between the two coasts of the growing United States by a horse rider relay had been floated years earlier. George Chorpening had his mule mail going from Salt Lake City to Los Angeles, but without federal help, he was about to lose the contract. California Senator William Gwynn had crossed the middle of the country to the West Coast in 1854 with Benjamin F. Ficklin, an enthusiastic supporter of closer communications with the East, who proposed that the government provide mail service using a mounted horse relay. The idea found favor with Aaron V. Brown, Postmaster General of the United States, and he in fact awarded a contract for a southern route to Benjamin Holliday. But there was a concern that with the growing threat of a civil war, a southern route would immediately become cut by Confederate troops. In May of 1859, Captain James H. Simpson of the United States Typographical Engineers surveyed a route from Camp Floyd, south of Salt Lake City, to Genoa, Nevada, in the eastern shadows of the Sierra Nevada, just south of Carson City. He hoped to cut the previously proposed route in half, find new grazing areas for the military, set up posts to control renegade Indians, and create an improved route for civilian use. Another unstated goal was to weaken the grip of the Mormons in the Great Basin. The survey expedition began in October of 1859. It consisted of a Mormon guide, a geologist, a number of laborers, and some 35 soldiers. The Simpson route from eastern Utah to the Carson Valley would be 260 miles shorter than the Humboldt route and 390 miles shorter than the southern Los Angeles route. Relative to Nevada, the Simpson route would cross the central desert instead of following the Humboldt River. While Simpson surveyed a potential route, political machinations toward establishing a Pony Express service were occurring within the federal government. Senator Gwin and his friend Ben Ficklin escalated their discussions of such an enterprise. Ficklin was a partner of Missouri freighting magnate William Russell. Ficklin got Russell involved, and in turn, Russell pressured Senator Gwin to help him get a congressional bill granting a large post office subsidy to launch the enterprise. Russell also pushed Secretary of War Floyd to bring to bear his substantial influence with the pro-Southern Congress to pass the Enabling Act for the Pony Express. What the eager participants in this plan didn't know, however, is that Secretary Floyd had no money in the post office fund. So Floyd diverted funds from other government accounts, but the funds were never equal to the expenses. While all the behind-closed-doors financial shenanigans were going on in Washington, William Russell and his partners, Alexander Majors and William Waddell, established the Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express, which consolidated already existing stagecoach stations, usually about every 10 to 12 miles, between St. Joe, Missouri and Salt Lake City, while building more and providing for their maintenance. Majors and Waddell, astute businessmen, weren't any too fond of Russell's idea. They felt that the expenses of such an enterprise would never be offset by the income, but they gave in to Russell's pressure. In less than 2 months from the time the three partners promised Gwin it would happen, they'd found horses and riders and personnel to man an ever-expanding rosary of stations across the western states. What the trio had put together nearly overnight was a virtual army, 80 riders, 500 horses, and 190 stations. The riders were lured to their $25 per week jobs by newspaper ads such as this: "Wanted, young, skinny, wiry fellows, not over 18, must be expert riders willing to risk death daily, orphans preferred." And once they were interviewed and seemed like a good prospect, they were required to take the following oath: "I, Rod Stock, do hereby swear before the great and living God that during my engagement and while I am an employee of Russell, Majors, and Waddell, I will, under no circumstances, use profane language, that I will drink no intoxicating liquors, that I will not quarrel or fight with any other employee of the firm, and that in every respect I will conduct myself honestly, be faithful to my duties, and so direct all my acts as to win the confidence of my employers, so help me God." Besides the $25 salary, the riders received two revolvers, a rifle, a bowie knife, and a gold imprinted Bible. All of these extras proved to be too much weight, so everything except one revolver and an extra loaded cylinder was left behind. The horses were well-broken animals, usually half-breed California Mustangs, known for their endurance. The mail was locked into four pockets on the mochila, our leather vest that was thrown over the saddle, and that could be transferred to the next horse in an instant. The letters, costing from $1 to $5 an ounce to transport, were wrapped in oiled silk and stuffed into the mochila's pockets. But even at $5 an ounce, offering totaling $100 a day in receipts, the Pony Express Enterprise was a losing proposition. The route between St. Joe and Sacramento fell under the jurisdiction of four division agents: A.E. Lewis at St. Joe, Joseph A., probably Jack Slade, at Julesburg, Howard Agin at Salt Lake City, and Bolivar Roberts at Carson City. There were roughly 30 Pony Express stations in what is today Nevada, and what was at the time of the Pony part of Utah Territory. The route through Nevada covered some 420 miles from Lake Tahoe in the west to the Goshute Indian Reservation in the east. What is today White Pine County, Nevada, featured 9 stations. With much but not all of what is it needed in place, the first Pony Express riders set off from opposite ends of the route, San Francisco in the west and St. Joseph, Missouri in the east, on April 3, 1860. A letter could now be mailed in St. Joe, and 10 days later it would arrive in Sacramento, from there to be carried on to San Francisco, usually by boat. By stage, the same letter had taken 24 days. Although the riders are historically seen as the heroes of the operation, there is plenty of danger and heroics to go around. The station masters and attendants had to live and work at the stations, where the elements were fierce and where they were cut off from military protection and had to literally be on guard 24 hours a day against Indian attacks, especially in the desolate middle of Nevada. The living conditions at the stations were primitive. Water was scarce. Materials to build and keep the station in repair were hard to come by. Many of the stations in Nevada didn't even have roofs. Equally important were the four superintendents who managed the line. As Arthur Chapman in his book, The Pony Express, says in talking about the superintendents, such men were on the trail most of the time, meeting and disposing of emergencies as they arose. It was up to the division superintendent to see that the livestock was kept in good condition, to apprehend horse thieves, to keep stations supplied when no supplies were in sight, to see the substitutes were available when riders were sick or injured or had suddenly quit the service, and to build anew on the ruins of stations that had been destroyed by Indians. All the way from Kearney to Carson, each superintendent on his allotted part of the Pony Trail was general, judge, and jury. And what about what we earlier inferred with the anonymous pony riders? Well, as a group, they were, like an army seen from afar, they were faceless, all one of a kind. But up close, a number of them distinguished themselves, and it's worthwhile taking a long look at several of these legendary men as a way of gauging the mettle of the young, skinny, wiry fellows who signed on to rush the mail through hostile territory. Let's first regard Billy Tate, who, at 14 years old, was the youngest pony rider. Billy's route was between Carson City and Camp Ruby. Here is how William H. Floyd described this young hero in the book Phantom Riders of the Pony Express. Billy was not destined to grow any older. On his last run, he was waylaid by a war party of about a dozen Bannocks and Utes. Turning loose his pony with Indian arrows in its hide to warn the next station, Billy hid behind a huge boulder and prepared to fight the Indians and defend the mail. When the nearby station masters came to look for him, they found 7 dead Indians and Billy's arrow-riddled body. They respected courage, even in a fallen foe. They didn't touch the mochila. They didn't even take his scalp. Then there was Pony Bob. who in May of 1860 made the longest ride in the 18-month history of the Pony Express. This is the way the story goes according to the BLM's book on the Pony Express in Nevada. Part of Bob's fame came from his ride in May 1860 at the peak of Nevada's Indian troubles. It was the longest ride of the Pony Express, 380 miles and almost right on schedule. Bob described his experience to author William Lightfoot Visscher in later years. When I reached Reed Station on the Carson River, I found no change of horses, as all those at the station had been seized by the whites to take part in the approaching battle. I fed the animal that I rode and started for the next station called Buckland's, 15 miles further down the river. Buckland's is southwest of present-day Lahontan Reservoir. It was to have been the termination of my journey as I had changed my old route to this one, in which I had many narrow escapes and had been twice wounded by Indians. I had already ridden 75 miles from Friday Station south of Lake Tahoe, but to my great astonishment, the other rider refused to go on. The superintendent, W.C. Marley, was at the station, but all his persuasion could not prevail on the rider, Johnson Richardson, to take the road. Turning then to me, Marley said, "Bob, I will give you $50 if you will make this ride." I replied, "I will go at once." Within 10 minutes, when I had adjusted my Spencer rifle, which was a seven-shooter, and my Colt's revolver with two cylinders ready for use in case of emergency, I started. From the station onward, it was a lonely and dangerous ride of 35 miles without a change to the sink of the Carson. I arrived there all right, however, and pushed on to Sand Springs, through an alkali bottom and sand hills 30 miles farther, without a drop of water all along the route. At Sand Springs, I changed horses and continued on to Cold Springs, a distance of 37 miles. Another change and a ride of 30 more miles brought me to Smith's Creek. Here I was relieved by J.G. Kelly. I had ridden 190 miles stopping only to eat and change horses. This was the fastest ride made on the entire 2,000-mile route during the Pony Express history. He continues, "After remaining at Smith's Creek about 9 hours, I started to retrace my journey with the return express. When I arrived at Cold Springs, to my horror, I found that the station had been attacked by Indians, the keeper killed, and all the horses taken away. I decided in a moment what course to pursue. I would go on. I watered my horse, having ridden him 30 miles on time. He was pretty tired and started for Sand Springs, 37 miles away. It was growing dark and my road laid through heavy sagebrush, high enough in some places to conceal a horse. I kept a bright lookout and closely watched every motion of my poor pony's ears, which is a signal for danger in an Indian country. I was prepared for a fight, but the stillness of the night and the howling of the wolves and coyotes made cold chills run through me at times. But I reached Sand Springs in safety and reported what had happened. Before leaving, I advised the station keeper to come with me to the sink of the Carson, for I was sure the Indians would be upon him the next day. He took my advice and so promptly saved his life, for the following morning Smith's Creek was attacked. When I arrived at the sink of the Carson, I found the station men badly frightened, for they had seen some 50 warriors decked out in their war paint and reconnoitering. I rested here an hour, and after dark started to Buckland's, where I arrived without mishap and only 3.5 hours behind scheduled time. I found Mr. Marley at Buckland's, and when I related to him the story of the Cold Springs tragedy and my success, he raised his previous offer of $50 for my ride to $100. I was rather tired, but the excitement of the trip had braced me up to withstand the fatigue of the journey. After a rest of 1.5 hours, I proceeded over my own route from Buckland's to Friday Station, crossing the Sierra Nevada. I had traveled 380 miles within a few hours of scheduled time and was surrounded by perils on every hand. Wow, it's exhausting just to talk about it. One more pony rider profile before we sum up the Pony Express and its impact on our history. This tale is about Elijah Nicholas Wilson, known as Uncle Nick, and concerns an incident at Spring Valley Station in White Pine County. This tale is also from the BLM publication, as is in Nick's own words. I paid my share of it in full one day out near Spring Valley Station in Nevada. Two boys, whose father and mother had died of cholera on the plains, were then tending that station. An old man who should have been in charge had gotten scared of engines and deserted these youngsters, but they stayed at the post like young heroes. When I dashed up there one day, they asked me to have a bite of dinner with them, so I stopped a little while to get the lay of the situation. Jerking off the mochila and the saddle, I turned out my pony, but instead of going into the stable as usual, he trotted off to where some other horses were grazing. A few minutes later, we looked to see the horses going across the meadow with two Indians behind them. We dashed after them. I was firing my revolver as I ran, but the shots fell short. The Indians reached the cedar trees before we could. I had outdistanced the boys and was running on in hope of getting a better shot at the thieves, when just as I was rounding a big cedar tree, one of the devils let fly an arrow which caught me right in the head about 2 inches above the left eye. As I tumbled over, the Indians ran on with the horses, leaving me with the two boys. They tried bravely to help me, pulling at the flint-headed shaft until it came out, leaving the flint in my forehead. Feeling sure I would die, they rolled me under the shade of the cedar tree and ran as fast as they could to the next station for help. Next morning, some men were there to bury me, but finding me alive, they put off the funeral. I was carried to the station, and a doctor was brought from Ruby Valley. All he did was to get the flint out of my head and leave me there in care of the boys. He had no hope that I would recover. When Major Egan came along some days later and found me still breathing, he sent that doctor back again with orders to do something. I had been unconscious all the while, but after time I was brought back to my senses, and then I began to get better fast. In a few weeks I was riding the Pony Express again, but I have had terrible headaches at different times all my life from the wound made by that flint-headed arrow, proving that it's not easy to kill a pony rider. Anyway, the end of the Pony Express came on October 28, 1861. 4 days after the Transcontinental Telegraph Line was completed. Now a message that took 10 days to travel the route could make the journey in less than 10 seconds. In the 18 months that the Pony Express lasted, it put its owners into debt to the tune of $500,000. As I wrote many years ago in a piece titled The Pony Express Experiment, it undoubtedly kept California and the territories of Oregon, Nevada, and Utah loyal to the Union. The gold and silver mining areas of California, Nevada, and Colorado were kept tied to the eastern business and banking interests. This experiment brought about a drastic change in the U.S. mail service, and over 400 young mail riders became overnight heroes to the world for their all-time feats of horsemanship never to be equaled. So ends this tale by Rod Stock.